Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I have the privilege of being the part-time minister here. My name is Sandy Ingham, and we like to welcome you wherever you are on your journey, on this journey of life, whether you call it the religious journey, the spiritual journey, the mysterious journey. We welcome you wherever you are. We welcome you no matter the color of your skin, your sexual preference, your gender. I do like to say, I'm kind of looking to see if we have anybody brand new, but if you are new or if this is one of your first times, please try to come back because our services are different every Sunday morning. Sometimes I do them. Sometimes someone from outside the Unitarian Universalist community does them. Sometimes someone from within does it, like this morning with John Wunderland. Looking forward to your presentation. If there are any new people or first-time, second-time people who would like to introduce themselves, we have a spot for that later on in the service. The opening words, then, are these, and they're Carl Sagan's words. The cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation, as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries. Holly, I need a chalice lighter. Would you light it? Thank you. Hope, respect, and love, three important treasures of spiritual life. May they always be in our hearts. May we always give them generously. The light of this flame is a symbol of them too, as hope, respect, and love are the cornerstones of our free religious path. And now it's my pleasure to introduce John Wunderland as our speaker. Many of you will know John because he and his wife have been coming here for a while. John's a founding member of the Iowa County Astronomers and a member of both the Wyalusing Star Splitters, not Star Spitters, Star Splitters, and the Madison Astronomical Society. He's been active in the astronomy clubs with talks and sharing many of his telescopes during public outreach. And did you, are you bringing your telescope? I heard a rumor.
Next week, hopefully.
To winter, well, we hope there are clear skies.
Yes, me too.
John.
Can everybody hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, great. In one of our recent talks in church, I was thinking about giving this presentation. I've given this several times to schools and to public presentations at Wyalusing State Park, and I thought it might be appropriate for us. Hopefully you don't all know all of this information already, but if you do, it's fun to think about anyway. There, oops. So I wanted to tie the talk in a little bit to UUism, because it's not entirely, in fact, it's very much not faith-based. But I wanted to share why, what I feel about astronomy and why I'm glad I found the UU Church. My first point was how I feel about the scientific method, and at first I thought, it's my faith in the scientific method. And then I thought, that's not really the right word. As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. So then I thought, belief in the scientific method, and I almost have to say it's really my trust in the scientific method. And the scientific method is not really very good at explaining the universe, but it's better than all of the other options out there. It's kind of like democracy. I hope I'm not blocking the screen here. So when I was young, I grew up Catholic, and I always tell people I gave it up for Lent. And I came to the realization that if God created the universe for humans, why is it that 99.999, and this number, the nines will probably extend to Michigan, percent of the universe is completely hostile to human life. Even on Earth itself, the majority of the planet, if you're unprotected, you're going to drown in the ocean. So that, for me, that was like, I think there's more to this. But then, are we just a lucky accident? I'm not sure. And then, again, my beliefs. Do we really need supernatural explanations for the universe when the reality of the natural universe is so amazing? Here we go. I wanted to talk just briefly about my background in astronomy. My earliest memory is when I was about 5 years old, and I was playing in the neighbor's sandbox in Platteville. And my friend's mother leaned out the window and said, "John, you gotta go home right now, you gotta go home right now." So I ran home, ran into our living room, and came into the family room where our whole family was gathered around our TV set, and there was a black and white picture of Neil Armstrong stepping down onto the moon. And you're all huddled around, I'm sure some of you were as well. It made quite an impression on me. When my father was in sales, and he won a telescope when I was about 10 years old. And it was a horrible, horrible instrument that I realize now, but I took it outside, and I pointed it up at the brightest star I could see in the sky, and I got it focused, and I looked through it, and darn if that star looked like a crescent. And I was completely baffled at the time. I was like, why does it look like a mini moon? Now I know that was actually the planet Venus. So I just happened to be lucky that I found something like that. That was quite an experience. Then my first real telescope, when I was 40 years old, my mother sent me a nice fat check. And I immediately said, "Good telescope." So I bought a 10-inch Dobsonian and spent many, many hours, as my wife can tell you, in our backyard, looking up at the sky. And there was a little computer on it that it could tell me, I could point to a whole lot of different objects, and that was a great experience. And I got all excited about it. And I got so excited about it, I met a friend in Dodgeville who had a little website devoted to astronomy, and he and I got together and we decided we needed to start an astronomy club. And that is still going strong. We've got over 100 members in Iowa County. We usually only have about 20 at each meeting, but that's been a lot of fun, and we do outreach for the public, and it's really enjoyable. And then I've also participated frequently in the Universe in the Park programs. And if you're not familiar with that, it's a program that astronomers from UW-Madison go out to state parks all across Wisconsin and do a presentation similar to what I'm doing. And then the public comes and looks through their telescopes. And it's kind of funny. The first one we did, the astronomers at Madison tend to not actually know how to run these small telescopes. And the very first program I did at Governor Dodge State Park, we got my astronomy club all set up, and the real astronomer came up the stairs and saw us, and she didn't realize we were like in the parking lot. She said, "Oh great, the amateurs are here. They always make us look bad." She was very nice. Once you get heavy into astronomy, your wallet opens up and it just bleeds all over the place. I got into astrophotography, which is not something you want to get into if you enjoy keeping your money. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is distances in space. So I've got a question for everybody. If you're in a car driving in an imaginary highway at 65 miles an hour, like Highway 151, and imagine there is a road going all the way to the moon, How long do you think it would take you to get there?
More than an hour.
Any guesses?
A lifetime.
A lifetime?
Light year.
Light year?
No, a year.
One year? That's, the answer is 153 days. Oh, that's pretty close, half a year. Now that's without any potty breaks. It's 240,000 miles to the moon. Now, how far away is the sun? Same deal, roadway to the sun. 40 years?
Times
40.
You'd burn up?
Well, you would. pretend we could do it.
It was an asbestos car.
Asbestos car, yes. 163 years. And again, still no body breaks. That's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You'd have to have a new fuel source, too. It's 93 million miles to the sun, approximately. So, miles are not a practical way to measure astronomical distances. Light is the fastest thing in our universe, and it travels at 186,000 miles per second. And that's how fast the beam of laser light goes. Light can circle the Earth 7 times in 1 second. So now,
what's the sun take to get light to us?
We're going to get there. I'm glad you asked. So how far away is the moon at the speed of light, does anyone know?
2 seconds.
2 seconds, it's very close. It's about 1.3 seconds. And when Neil Armstrong, when the astronauts were on the moon and they were talking to mission control, there was always this delay. It would be about 3 seconds. They would speak, and then there would be a delay, and then it would come back. It's because it literally took a 3 second round trip for light to bounce back and forth.
John.
Oh yeah. Well, and actually, Einstein did a thought experiment when he was actually working on the theory of relativity, and his experiment was, what would happen if I was riding a beam of light? So I thought, what better way to represent this than a jockey riding a beam of light? So the sun is 8 minutes away by light. So if the sun blew up right this instant, we wouldn't know about it for 8 minutes. Then we'd know about it. So some other distances in terms of time. The moon, 1.3 seconds, sun, 8 minutes. Mars is about 12 minutes away. Jupiter is 43 minutes. And these are all the beam of light. Saturn, an hour and a half. That's interesting. So Saturn is actually almost twice as far away as Jupiter from us. And Pluto, which is not actually a planet anymore, I'll talk about that in a little bit, is 5.5 hours out. So the nearest star system to us is called Alpha Centauri, and at that same scale, the beam of light will take almost 4.5 years to reach the star system, and that's the closest star. Oh, it's a trinary star system, and we don't have any kids in here, but you've all seen Star Wars, the original Star Wars, when Luke is on the horizon and there's two stars in the sky. Potentially, one of the planets he was on was in Alpha Centauri, because there's actually three stars, but the Proxima Centauri is this little tiny red dwarf that's way out. But you probably see the two big stars. And the Milky Way galaxy from end to end is 100,000 light years. Again, same scale. So from one end to the other, a beam of light would take 100,000 years to cross it. And this is actually a representation of, this is the best guess of the Milky Way galaxy from NASA right now. And this is where we're at. We're in one of the outer bands of the galaxy. And they've discovered that it's actually what's called a barred spiral. That's a relatively recent discovery. So our galaxy is not the only galaxy. There are billions of galaxies, and one of the closest galaxies to us is the Andromeda Galaxy, and that's 2.5 million years away by a beam of light. And now we're going to the very edge of the known universe. This is actually, they found this, since I've done this slide, they found something further than this, but it's relatively the same distance. A gamma ray burst, there's some discussion on what a gamma ray bursts are. They think it may be black holes merging, is one possibility. That's pure speculation, they don't really know. But this this is actually an image from the Hubble Space Telescope, and it is about 13 billion, with a B, years distance by that same beam of light. So just in summary, light speed is how astronomers measure distance. It's a measurement of how far light travels over time. The moon distance of 1.3 seconds is the same scale as the edge of the universe at 13 billion years. So, any quick questions on distance?
Can you use the...
Yeah, I'll just repeat it so we don't need the microphones. So the question is, do satellites use light to communicate? And they do, but they use something called radio waves, which radio is actually a form of light, and it travels at the same speed as a beam of light. It's just a different frequency. Yeah, a black hole is basically a star that has gotten so large. So a beam of light, you think of this beam of light as being unstoppable. It's actually not unstoppable. Gravity in a high enough amount of gravity can actually bend a beam of light, can actually alter its direction. A black hole is a star that's gotten so big that light can't escape. So it's so huge that if you shot this beam of light up, it would curve around and come right back down. So it's black because no light can escape. And it's something on the order of thousands of times larger than our sun for the smallest black hole. There's a black hole in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, Milky Way, not Andromeda, Milky Way galaxy, that's something on the order of a million times the mass of our sun. It's yeah. Yep. So the question is, how can a beam of light have enough matter to be affected by gravity? And that's, I'm not sure they know the answer to that one either, but they've been able to do testing to see that beam, that light does move it. And actually, if I don't know if you saw on the headline news just the other day, there was a picture of a galaxy they called the Smiling Face. There's two really big galaxies, and there was a great big swoop underneath them. And what that swoop is a background galaxy, light from the background galaxy that got distorted. It actually got stretched into a curve. So it was a cute picture, but it's called an Einstein. I thought John Rubble was going to come; he would know what that was. He didn't come. It's an Einstein something, but Einstein predicted that would be the case, but nobody had seen one until the Hubble Space Telescope was built. So we're going to move on to size now, instead of distance. So this is, and I'll try to keep moving around so everybody can see. So this is from NASA. This is the scale of our of the sun and all of the main planets to scale. Just to give you, we are here. And we're gonna do this and zoom in a little bit. So we can see the relative sizes of Earth, Venus, Mars, Mercury, and Pluto, which is not a planet. Now we're zooming out. Here's Earth. And Jupiter would swallow us. And in fact, the Great Red Spot is larger than our planet.
No.
And here's the sun, and here's us. More than a million Earths can be stuffed inside of our sun. But our sun is actually not a very big star. Here's Sirius. This time of year, you can see Sirius in the south. It's one of the brightest stars up in the sky. Pollux and Arcturus, which is pretty huge. At this scale, Jupiter is one pixel in size, and Earth is invisible. It's so small compared to these stars. And yet, Arcturus, from the last slide, is still not the biggest stars. There are even bigger ones, Rigel, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, and Antares. Antares is so large that if Antares was our star, where our sun is, we would be orbiting inside the star. And we'll see if this works. So next I'm going to share my personal journey with astrophotography. This is my house in Mineral Point. It was my previous house, and we don't live there anymore. And I built an observatory in my backyard. So this is kind of a funny story. This is the construction company in Mineral Point called Ivy's, and they came out to pour this big 2-foot diameter concrete pier in my yard, and I said, I bet you've never poured concrete for a telescope observatory before. And they said, actually, they poured the concrete for the piers in Wyalusing, at the Wyalusing Observatory. So they knew what they were doing. And here's the foundation. And there's my final product. I miss that. I sold it with our house. But it wouldn't be very useful in Madison, unfortunately. Light pollution. And that's my main scope that I'm going to share with you all of the astrophotography that I've done, and all of the pictures came from this, either this telescope, or I've actually got several telescopes hooked together. There's another one up here. So all of these pictures are with this equipment. So here's the moon. And I had the distance to 1.3 seconds, but you all remember that. So this is the M13 Hercules star cluster, and it's about 25,000 years away. Only the moon. I don't think I've got anything in here that's visible to the naked eye. This is visible in binoculars. Oh, that's a good question. Is this a version of the Milky Way? This is actually inside the Milky Way galaxy. It's basically a cluster of stars that are all gravitationally bound. So it's not a galaxy, but it's, I think it is about 100,000 stars that are all packed into this thing. And I had a kid at one of my presentations say, what would it be like to be on a planet inside there? It's like, oh, that would be something else. The whole star would be lit up by, you wouldn't have a nighttime, it'd be all, it would all be a faint glow from the solid stars, would be something. And these stars are all, also the star clusters like this are very old. So they're some of the oldest stars in our galaxy. So maybe there are civilizations in there, we don't know. Why are stars round? It's because they're so large that gravity collapses them into that shape. And they rotate, but they're round because if anything gets too big, it falls down. And you know, you think about it, the center of gravity pulls it all in. Oh, well, the question is, since it's 25,000 years away, what are the odds that it's still there? Really good, because most stars live to be billions of years. So it very likely still looks very much like this. Well, the stars are made of gas, you know, burning a nuclear fusion. So they're plasma, actually. They're not molten. This is a galaxy that I imaged, M33, and it's 2.5 million light years away. Just a little further than the Andromeda Galaxy. And there's a nebula right here, which I was pretty proud of being able to capture. So it's a nebula in another galaxy. It's not even in our galaxy. I was pretty excited about that. This is the Pleiades. And this is pretty close to us, relatively speaking, 440 light years. The Cave Nebula. These are all my pictures, yeah. And this picture is, I have a special filter on my telescope that lets me capture near-infrared data. Because this is almost all in the infrared, all of this red color. another galaxy, M51. There was a supernova in M51 last year, and our club has one of our members of the Iowa County Astronomers donated a 17-inch telescope, which doesn't sound like very much, but it's about 7 feet tall. And has just fantastic mirror, and we were able to see that supernova just easy. You can actually see a lot of the structure, and the supernova was somewhere around here. Right, 25 million years. Last year it became visible to us. Correct. Yes. Yeah. So the question is the color that you see in all of the space pictures and my pictures, are they actual colors or are they... They modified. I in all of my pictures, I try to, I don't change the color tone at all. I do brighten it so you can see the colors. But most of those pictures are, if you were in space, it'd be pretty close to what you see. So they're normally real colors. That Cave Nebula that I showed, that's red. Since it's in the infrared, if you were there, you probably wouldn't see nearly as much. But infrared is past the red end of the color spectrum. So most astronomers use red to represent it. So if you were there, you might not be able to detect it because it's mostly infrared light, not visible light. Hold that thought. I've got a slide coming up real quick here. I want to talk about that. So the question was how long do supernovas, the light from the supernovas last? I'm going to talk about that in just like two more slides. This is the Bubble Nebula. And this star right here is causing all of this gas to expand. It's called a Wolf-Rayet star, and it's basically a super unstable star, and it's throwing out its atmosphere. And again, this is mostly infrared light. This picture took me, I think it was about 8 hours of data collection. So I had the telescope stuck right in the spot for 8 hours. Another galaxy, NGC 891, that's a pretty one. I like the pretty pictures. Here we go. This is a Crab supernova. This is a supernova remnant. And this exploded, this blew up about 1,000, well, so it'd be about 8,000 years total. She's gonna catch me on that. This blew up, I think it was about 1,000 BC. Give or take, I don't remember the exact numbers, but what's interesting about this is that the Chinese astronomers at the time recorded the event, and it was a new star at night, and it was so bright it was visible during the day for a month, so it was pretty big deal, and then it faded from view, and was never to be found again until the 1700s when first telescopes started. First decent telescopes. Galileo's telescopes were terrible. Any binocular is way better than what he had. But in the 1700s, they started making actual good instruments, and they rediscovered the supernova. So this is the explosion from the supernova. And the thing I like, this is one of my favorite objects in the night sky. At the center of this is what's left of the star. It's a neutron star, and it's spinning. The neutron star is probably about the size of Fitchburg. It's a few miles in that diameter, and it's spinning at a rate of 30 times per second. Think about that for a minute. And when radio astronomers first started using radio telescopes for astronomy, they listened to basically radio waves coming from the stars. And I don't know if it was M1, but they found a neutron star spinning like this, and they didn't know what it was. They were listening in their headphones, and they heard this noise, and they're like, "We've discovered aliens." Nothing else could make a steady repeating pitch like that. But then they did some more research and realized that it's a neutron star that, you know, in the process of exploding, got so much energy infused onto it that it got this super rapid rotation rate, and it's super radioactive. You wouldn't want to be anywhere near this thing. You would be dead instantly.
Yeah, so the telescopes, the mechanism of the telescope counteracts the Earth's rotation, so that it can stay in the same, so it can stay, you know, as the stars are rotating, it follows them exactly. But the equipment isn't really good enough to perfectly do that. So I use I use something called an auto guider. So it locks onto one star and it makes micro adjustments to make sure that it stays right there. And I also don't take 1 9-hour exposure. I take a series of small, like 5-minute exposures, and then digitally combine them. Cuckoo Nebula, again, this is mostly infrared. It wouldn't be this pretty. M81. Does everything spin in the same direction? No. They can. I think most of the planets spin the same direction, except there's one, I think, that has retrograde. Neptune or Uranus. Yeah, one of them is going backwards. So it's I think partly it's the formation of our solar system was going in one direction, and I suspect that got that's my speculation. I don't know that for sure. But it's, and you know, in the formation of the planets, stuff was colliding with everything, and it just depends what Uranus or whichever one is going. It's called retrograde when it's going the opposite direction. Must have gotten smacked at the wrong time and got it spinning the other direction. So it was very violent in the formation of the solar system. Yeah, right. Big stuff getting eaten by bigger things. It's a Crescent Nebula. And I think this is actually the same type of star as the Bubble Nebula. I think it's a Wolf-Rayet star, if I remember right. This one, this is called, I used to haul this out at Halloween time. And if you can see the little ghosts here. Or they're little, actually these are little guys running away from a ghost. That's what they're like, ah! This picture was about 12 hours of data. This is very, very faint. And the horse head, you've probably recognize that one. The Orion Nebula, this is kind of a fun picture because it's the color for this that I used for this, my daughter actually did as a science project in high school. So I used her color data, and then so she imaged the Orion Nebula as a project with my observatory. And then I used her color data and put it on a black and white image from my hydrogen alpha filter. And that's how I got that picture. Sunflower Galaxy. There's some really interesting jets right here. I don't know if you can see those. I don't know what those are, but they're cool. And the Black Eye Galaxy. Looks like he got smacked. And last one. This is the Whale Galaxy. This is one of the last pictures I took before we moved. I'm going to skip the telescope tips. I just want to talk real quick. 5 minutes? Okay, I want to talk about current space missions. There's three really exciting space missions that are active right now. New Horizons, Dawn, and Rosetta. There are a lot of other missions too, but these are the three I wanted to touch on real quick. I'm going to go blow past this because I want to get to it. New Horizons is visiting Pluto. And last summer, it took its initial images. This is Pluto. And Charon, its largest moon, orbiting each other, and this is from January. By July, the spacecraft's going to be flying past Pluto. It doesn't have enough energy to stop in orbit, so it's going to only be spending a couple of days there. I hope all the equipment works right, and then it's going to zoom off because it's the fastest thing. It's the fastest spacecraft we've ever created because it was launched in 2006, so it took 9 years to get there. But it's moving at 36,000 miles an hour to reach it, even in 9 years. The Dawn spacecraft is a really interesting spacecraft because it uses an ion drive and can actually maneuver for quite a time. So it's visiting two bodies. This is Vesta, an asteroid, and this is the data that it took from it. And then it left orbit of Vesta and is now approaching Ceres. And this is Ceres, and this is data from just the last month or so. And this white spot here, they have no idea what that is, but it might be a lake of ice. it's something extremely reflective, so they're super excited about this. And then finally, Rosetta. It's actually a dwarf. It's a dwarf planet. You can see it's round. In fact, I'm hoping that it's rounder than Pluto is, because so that'll put the whole Pluto debate to bed. So Rosetta is from the European Space Agency. This is a comet. And Rosetta landed a lander on the surface of Rosetta last year. Unfortunately, it didn't. The gravity on Rosetta is so light that if I was standing on Rosetta and jumped, I could achieve escape velocity. I could actually jump off the thing and go into space. So the lander had trouble. It was supposed to use harpoons to grab onto the surface and ratchet itself down, but the harpoons didn't stick. So it bounced. It bounced several miles in the air three times and landed. But luckily, it was it's so gentle that it didn't. The spacecraft was okay, but it came down at an angle, so the solar panels weren't aligned right, and it only had about one day of data. But it got some really good information back before it died. And as this is approaching the sun, there's a chance that it will that lander spacecraft will light up again once those panels get some more light. So, but this is the comet on the surface. And this is actually a color picture. The color is great. Pretty much like the moon. What did Armstrong call it? Magnificent desolation. And then this is the comet is starting to become active now too. So the spacecraft has actually got in a longer orbit around the thing, so it's not getting pummeled by the material flowing off the comet. But it's going to stay there through the whole orbit, assuming it doesn't get knocked out of position. And that's it. Thanks so much. Penny, do we have time for a few questions?
No? I'm sorry.
All right,
John.
You'll have to catch me at dinner or at lunch.
Thank you, John. I think often we need to plan two-parters because there's still so much more. And I'm feeling just a little overwhelmed. Thank you, John. Closing words are these. There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened. Who found this quote? You? Thank you. This is wonderful. Yes, I think it may have already happened. We do the best we can. Thank you, John. Greet your neighbor, eat your soup, and come back.